are listening to Right On Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM, Minneapolis-St. Paul, and streaming live on the web at kfai.org. I'm Eric Bushnell. On tonight's program, Josh will be talking to Stephen E. Mayer to discuss his book, How to Save the World, Evaluating Your Choices. This book is for anyone who gets asked at least 10 times a week to give money to a charitable organization, anything from your college or place of worship, working to create solutions that might hold the world together. Mayer provides a guide to choosing a set of donations or investments that stand up to your own scrutiny so that you can feel your choices are meaningful and consistent with your values. All of this and more, so stay tuned to Right On Radio.
Hello, everyone. This is Josh Weber. Today, I'm joined in studio with Stephen E. Mayer, the lead strategist and consulting evaluator at Effective Communities Project, to discuss his book, How to Save the World, Evaluating Your Choices. This work offers guidelines and tips on how to consider a nonprofit's strengths and weaknesses and helps you prioritize requests so you can separate the wheat from the chaff. It gives an insight look at how nonprofits work, their missions and intended beneficiaries, and their challenge to make progress on their mission, the bottom line of any nonprofit organization. Mayer is an experienced program evaluator, consultant, and teacher working in the nonprofit and philanthropy industry. He has a PhD in industrial/organizational psychology from U of M and taught nonprofit program development and evaluation in the nonprofit management program at Johns Hopkins University as an adjunct faculty member. Stephen, welcome to Right On Radio.
Thank you very much, Josh. Glad to be here.
So we were talking in the green room a bit about the origins of this book. What was the impetus for writing How to Save the World?
Well, the world needs saving, and it's in a pretty dark place. As one of the people who used to do the drive time fundraising here, Willie Murphy, used to sing, the world is a neighborhood, and the neighborhood ain't doing so good. So that's a starting point, along with a career, really, a lifetime of working with nonprofits and foundations, helping them to discover the way forward to greater effectiveness, to greater values to their community, and hopefully to greater resources so they can do their job better.
You mentioned in the first chapter the work of nonprofit organizations, the importance of mission statements for nonprofit organizations. Can you talk about why that's valuable?
Well, a mission statement is the guide star, one might say, of the work of nonprofits. What distinguishes a nonprofit from a commercial organization is the mission statement. Well, actually, both have mission statements, but the mission of a for-profit business is to make money, to return a profit to their stakeholders. And the mission of a nonprofit, well, it's stated in many different ways, whether they're in arts and culture or in food advocacy or social justice, but making progress on the mission, whatever it is the primary job of any nonprofit.
You provide several criteria for examining nonprofits. Which criterion do you think is the most often overlooked by donors, and why is it crucial?
Well, by donors here in this book, I am speaking to people like you, Josh, and people listening to this radio show,
of course,
who are donors. You've written checks. You've certainly opened letters and opened emails asking for you to write checks. And as the lead-in suggested, we're all besieged with requests to donate. So somebody thinks we are donors. Individuals are donors. And it's difficult for people to really sort through all the invitations they get to be helpful as donors. And the book tries to be a guide to people like you and your neighbors and friends to help sort through the merits and strengths of different nonprofit organizations.
In discussing program strategies, you differentiate between nonprofits that benefit individuals, communities, and social systems. I was wondering if you could talk about any examples that come to mind for you that integrate all three strategies, and perhaps I might be asking a dangerous question here, but do you think KFAI is an example of an entity that does integrate all three?
Good question, and the answer is probably yes. Let me pull up KFAI's mission statement. I was prepared for this. It says, I also pulled up the mission statement for one of your competitors. We can look. Maybe
we can compare and contrast here.
I'll start with the competitor, a commercial news organization, they say, named for a furry little animal that begins with
whose name may rhyme with Rocks News.
Not a ferret. rhymes with rock. So they say, we empower a diverse range of creators to imagine and develop culturally significant content. I think that means fake news. While building an organization that thrives on creative ideas, operational expertise, and strategic thinking, we've long been a leader in news, sports, and entertainment programming, achieving strong revenue growth and profitability in a complex industry environment over the past several years, blah, blah.
So again,
that's about for-profit, mm-hmm. profitability, returning profit by doing something that makes profit. Whereas KFAI says, as its mission, KFAI is a volunteer-based community radio station that exists to broadcast information, arts, and entertainment programming for an audience of diverse racial, social, and economic backgrounds. By providing a voice for people ignored or misrepresented by mainstream media, KFAI increases understanding between peoples and communities while fostering the values of democracy and social justice. And KFAI lives this out in its 24-hour day by being a different radio station every hour, as the tagline says, mm-hmm. because they're speaking to different demographics and for different demographics, and everybody on air is intending through their own voice to increase understanding between peoples and communities and fostering the values of democracy and social justice. That is the mission, and the criterion for judging whether an organization is doing a good job is whether the organization is continually advancing this particular, their own particular mission, and trying to get better at it all the time, and trying to become a stronger organization so that it can do its mission better.
What do you see as then the biggest challenge for small nonprofit organizations in achieving their missions, and what are some options for overcoming it?
The biggest challenge, I think, is perhaps the reluctance of institutional funders, foundations, to try to understand a nonprofit in its own terms. In a nonprofit's own terms. Nonprofits have their own values, their own cultures, their own histories, their own voices. Yet, foundations, while they ask for applications, they count the number of characters that go onto the electronic digital application form and do not invite serious dialogue or an attempt to understand what that nonprofit is all about. That is a significant barrier.
You highlight the role of individuals in supporting nonprofit work. What advice would you give to someone looking to maximize their impact when choosing which organizations to support?
Yeah. Well, I think the whole idea of changing the world, as grandiose a title as it is, has actually some chance of coming to pass if individuals decide to pay attention in the same way I've been suggesting that institutions pay attention with respect, pay attention to what others, the so-called others, are saying to you so that you can understand them better. So when when a request for support comes to you as an individual donor by email, start with, don't start by saying no immediately. Don't start by tossing it into the delete pile. I'm guilty of this too sometimes, you know, mood happens. But when I bring my best self forward with an intent to understand their work, their mission, because they've put as much work into formulating their mission and recruiting people and recruiting a board and recruiting resources. People in the nonprofit sector are very intentional and devotional, one could even say, in making their mission come true. And so I think it behooves us as individual donors in their audience to pay attention.
Let's talk about this further then. Can you elaborate then on the difficulties nonprofits face when constructing a theory of action and suggested ways they can better articulate this to potential supporters?
Theory of action. I can't believe you brought that up.
You brought it up.
I did. I brought it up so I could knock it down.
I learned by reading you.
Theory of action is one of those contrivances that, I mean, they may have been invented with some intention. The intention there is that funders want to understand what a nonprofit is doing. Yeah. I think they would like to understand it. But so they've created this exercise called logic models and theory of action, where they make the nonprofit, you know, list all the inputs and all the outcomes and all the this and that's, you know, that's part of nonprofit management jargon. And nonprofits hate the exercise, I think, because it's asking them to explain the logic of their actions. Now, how would you like that, Josh, if someone were to ask you to explain the logic of your actions? Would that be an opportunity you would look forward to?
That sounds like an exhausting endeavor, yeah.
Yeah. So instead, what I suggest is that that nonprofit boards and staff, instead of a theory of action, instead hold that mission statement on the blackboard or whatever is used now and
smart
do a kind of a an exercise where they brainstorm all the things they've done in the last week or 6 months or year to make each of those different parts of the mission come true. All the things that KFAI has done to increase understanding between peoples and communities. All the things KFAI has done to foster the values of democracy and social justice. Those would be a good presentation for individual donors to read in an invitation. Good thing to put on the website. A good thing to put on the funders' applications, even if it does take a number of characters. We have to change the game so that funders are more required to listen to what nonprofits actually do.
You mentioned the need for nonprofits to build capacity in some various areas. What are the most common areas where nonprofits underinvest, do you think?
Oh, yeah. Well, capacities, you know, the key ones have to do with administration, you know, staff and board. They have to do with fundraising and communications. They have to do with putting sensible programs together that deliver the goods for the people that they intend to deliver the goods for. But the least attended to is community interconnection, actually, between or among different nonprofit organizations that have every reason to be allied in their work. But, the dominant fundraising model has nonprofits be competitive with other nonprofits. And this competition is not healthy. So many organizations here in town focus on, let's say, food issues, hunger issues. Yet they operate kind of in vacuums. I think what they need is instead to have people on staff who reach out to their allies and try to make things happen together. They would love to, of course, but they don't have the staff. It takes money, obviously, to have a staff person so that KFAI could relate to even NPR or MinnPost or established and non-established news and storytelling sources. But that kind of staff person takes money. Commercial organizations have that. People in commercial organizations are paid to go to meetings to create partnerships, to create alliances. But people in scruffy little nonprofits are not paid to do that kind of thing. And so they work 60-hour weeks, lots of overtime. They don't get paid for because they carry the passion of the mission. But if funders, institutional funders, were serious about nonprofits becoming a constructive force for good in this community so that together they can help save the world, they would encourage this kind of networking and alliance building and coalition building. There are lots of coalitions that have come to be formed in all walks of nonprofit life. They need money to work with more people, build up the networking strength, build up the coalition strength of nonprofits.
What strategies do you think then can nonprofits do to better educate their donors about the complexities and challenges they face in achieving their missions?
Yeah, I think they have to be more forthcoming in describing what they really are doing to advance their mission. They have to communicate this with assertiveness and pride, and even tell their audiences what are the obstacles to their growth, obstacles of all different kinds. Every organization knows what its own set of obstacles are. I think they're afraid of speaking out about what they are for fear of looking weak. And I think instead, if they had some good talk, plan about what they would do to overcome their limitations to become stronger, they could invite support for getting stronger.
Let me ask you a follow-up question you're going to hate me for, Steve, then. How can nonprofits balance their roles in direct service and advocacy without overstretching the resources they have available?
I'm going to hate you for that question.
I'm sorry.
I might even ask you to repeat it because it's such a big one. Go ahead.
How can nonprofits, do you think, balance their roles in direct service and advocacy without overstretching their resources?
Well, that's where a chief partnership officer would be a good addition. Someone to help the organization think beyond the immediacy of direct service.
Sorry, what's the role of this person? What, say the name again?
I called it a chief partnership officer. Not chief marketing or chief communications or chief, but chief partnership.
CPO.
CPO, you could say, because the idea is to strengthen the interconnections and find common cause, find ways to work together, get funding to work together to advance a common purpose.
Okay. So you're proposing reversing the traditional priorities in nonprofit work. What resistance have you seen to these ideas, and how would you propose addressing them?
Well, you know, historically, the first work of nonprofits have been charities where direct service is provided, you know, in the areas of food and clothing and shelter and safety. You know, the items are at the lower levels of Maslow's hierarchy
of needs, right?
Yeah, that's right. And this is where faith-based charities have emerged. The earliest charities were addressing those kind, and the earliest charities were faith-based, and all the major faith traditions mandate that their culture, our cultures, make sure that our people are not hungry or without homes or shelter or security. So that deserves support, there's no doubt. The more recent kind of efforts have to do with promoting system change through advocacy such that these systems are better able to take care of hunger and homelessness and security, so that it's not just the churches that are responsible for making those things happen, but that our public systems are more likely to be helpful. Now, nonprofits they're not in charge of those systems, but they are the skunk works, you might say, of experimentation, where new solutions get designed and tried out with support and improved upon and hopefully gone to scale a little bit more, although scale, I think, requires public support and it's just taxpayer support. And that's probably a subject we shouldn't get into, isn't that right? That's one of those areas where it's like almost swear words, right?
Possibly.
So the role of nonprofits and the role of individual donors is to promote solutions that could go to scale to fix the kinds of problems that our public systems are facing.
In Chapter 4, you mentioned that evaluation is often more political than scientific. Could you elaborate further on this point?
I thought that's what I've been talking about. Yes. Evaluation gets promoted as a science, as a social science. And social scientists are hired to do evaluation. And, you know, there's people in foundation staffs who've all had some courses in social science, and they would say that social science is the way to go. And so they demand that a nonprofit provide proof that you are increasing the democratic capital or the social justice, the level of social justice in this city. Well, you can't provide proof of that. And the demands for proof are silly. It can't be done. There's no laboratory work that can be done. Instead, we can be empirical, however, which is the root of all science, and that is to begin to notice the sorts of changes that our nonprofit programming can do.
All right, then. Well, then, let me ask you then a follow-up question. In what ways can nonprofits effectively use qualitative data to complement this quantitative measures of the progress then?
Yeah, quantitative is sort of overranked, I think, overvalued. There are ways. One can think about, you know, categories. One can think about, you know, send people out with a job of noticing how many signs of democratic or compassionate, let's say, or behavior that exhibits dignity or responsibility towards others. What does that look like? How do we describe that? Description, storytelling, writing, informed journalistic writing and inquiry about the kinds of immediate outcomes that could be expected from exposure to KFAI programming.
Well, I'm kind of curious then. So have there been social scientists that you encounter or try to quantify some value metric like dignity or empathy or anything like that? And then what do you say to those people?
I discourage them. If quantified means, you know, creating some sort of scale like an IQ scale, no, let's not do that. If quantified means, you know, how many instances of this kind of behavior do we see, or how many examples of that kind of behavior, you know, have a set of behaviors that you're wanting to see more of, then you send people out to look for those. It's about observation, observing the kinds of changes that you're hoping to see in the very, very short run, and counting those off and trying to make more of those happen through better programming.
I'm very close to the end of our time here, Steve. I got one, I think, room for one more question here. All right. So how can individual donors like our listeners develop strategies or developing a strategic plan that maximizes their impact?
Where did you learn these words? Strategic planning for maximizing impact. Okay. I can go there. I do go there in classes that I teach and webinars I do for nonprofits and foundations.
I looked up, I did my research and found this organizational industrial psychology. Perhaps I should speak in a jargon he understands, maybe. So this is what I did. I'm wrong. Well, I'm sorry.
Well, I think it's important for people to better understand where their values lie and what they'd like to see more of. Every time you open an envelope with a solicitation and you're inclined to say no to, stop and ask yourself, why am I saying no? Why doesn't this not ring my bell? Conversely, something will ring your bell, and ask yourself, what is it about this that I like? What about their mission do I like? Okay, let's go further. Let's look at their website. Let's look at their activities to see if they align well with the mission. And think critically about that. And then a third big question is, do they have the horsepower to make this mission happen, to make progress on their mission? Horsepower meaning the staffing, the organizational base, the technical know-how, the whole infrastructure, that stuff. And it gets you thinking about the inner workings of a nonprofit. And my book actually goes into some detail about that. It sort of gives a guide to the sort of plan that a person like you could, without using excessive jargon this time, a person like you could put together to inform yourself on the possibilities and to that in a way that sheds a light for a path forward for you to increase your own impact and usefulness in the nonprofit world.
This has been my time talking to Stephen Mayer about his book, How to Save the World. Available now wherever books are sold and on Amazon. Stephen, I guess thanks for coming on the program.
Well, Josh, I've heard so much about you. And I'm glad finally to be here.
And now this.
You have been listening to Right On Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM in Minneapolis, and streaming live online at kfai.org. I'm Eric, and we would like to thank Stephen E. Mayer and all of our listeners. Without your support, KFAI would not be possible.